All right, good morning. Good morning, good morning. I'm glad to see so many of you enjoy getting up early like we do here in the Midwest. When we did the program schedule, we had so many really outstanding papers that we filled the days up pretty quickly, but I think this is a conference that will give you a lot of value for your dollar, as we say in public broadcasting. I'm Chuck Haddix, and I'm the director of the Marsound Archives here at the university, and I want to welcome you to the 30th annual ARSC conference. And we're going to keep our remarks short because we want to stay on track this morning, and I'm definitely looking forward to hearing Professor Seaver's talk. I want to introduce the president of ARSC now, Jerry Weber, and he's the outgoing president and has served the organization well. And then he, in turn, will introduce Jerry Fabris, our program chair.
Good morning. It's so good to see all of you here. And I just wanted to explain, I was afraid Chuck would beat me to it, just wanted to explain why we're starting at 8 o'clock. You all watch television, don't you? You know how they're always telling about the movie that's coming up? 9 o'clock Eastern, 8 Central. So here we are. I have, they never say that. I have something to show you. Is Barry here? Ashpole? Yeah, is he? He's not. This is too bad because this is going to fall flat if I can't pull this on Barry. I wanted to suggest that maybe we were going to have a new cover design and title for the ARSC Journal, but since Barry isn't here, I can't, you know, strike fear into his heart. But I want to show it to you, okay? It's called the National Discographic. I'm so glad I came across that last month. It's going to be a great conference. So we were in Kansas City once before, and I'm really glad we're back again. Our program chairman, second vice president, is Jerry Fabris of the Edison National Historic Site. One of our younger members, you're going to hear that phrase over and over this week. There's a real sense among those of us who have been spending a lot of time in ARSC, and I mean a lot of years, that we need to encourage the younger members, both young in age and in number of years in the organization, with assuming their rightful role. Jerry is one of those, and it's been a pleasure to work with him. And I'm particularly pleased at how smoothly he has done the job of program chairman. Jerry, you can introduce everybody from now on, okay? Thank you.
Hi, thanks for coming. I'd like to just jump right into the speakers because we have a really packed schedule. First couple speakers come highly recommended by Chuck Haddix. First off, James E. Seaver. James Seaver is a professor of history emeritus at University of Kansas. He has been a collector of operatic records since 1935 and helped the University of Kansas archive become formed in 1979 with a gift of 25,000 operatic records. He also was given a one-hour radio program each week called Opera's My Hobby on KANU-FM.
Thank you. It's a great honor to be asked to speak here, and I look forward to it very much. I also have a number of the recordings that you're going to hear from over there, so you can see where all the bad music comes from. I have put these materials on tape for you, and I hope that you find some enjoyment from them, despite the problems that you'll hear when we get going here. This is kind of an irreverent program in many ways, and I've got to stick to my script or else I'll ad-lib my way out of the place. So I've written a script and I'll stay mostly to it, although I have a bad habit of ad-libbing. Anyway, we're going to hear some operatic oddities today, some bad records by good singers. They're not all great singers by any means, but good singers, vocal giants, most of them in off moments. There's a kind of cult, I think, of operatic enthusiasts and phonophiles who seem to feel that great singers can do no wrong, that the golden age singers, say from 1890s to 1920 or something, were perfection. Whenever they mention Caruso or Scotti or Tetrazzini, you know, why they suddenly become emotionally overwhelmed or something. Anyway, and they cease to be objective whatsoever. Today's program, then, is intended kind of as an antidote for those who've fallen victim to this kind of idolatry. I, for one, think very highly of many singers who recorded long ago, and I think very highly of many recording now, like Domingo and so on. But just as we hear our modern singers make errors, particularly on Metropolitan Opera broadcasts, which they do most every week, some singers were better one day than another, and so the Golden Age artists, Sembrich or Ames or Tamagno, some that you're going to be hearing, Calvé, made errors and sang poorly on occasion. And some of these mistakes, which make them only more human and interesting as far as I'm concerned, have been preserved to us by the phonograph. Now I want to make a technical note, and that is that all the records are going to be heard as listeners would have heard them when they were purchased. I think that's the fair way to do this. Victor's at 78 and Columbia's at 80. These were the speeds that were advertised by the record companies, and most records had on them no speeds noted. Some did, but most of them didn't. And few people in the old days fiddled with their speed controls all the time, unless they turned them all the way down or all the way up for fun or something. Most of them, if they had Victor's, stayed at 78 and Columbia's at 80 and so on. Now, many of the Golden Age artists then were really great, but all but a couple that we hear today approached stature, at least they were good singers, and we have abundant proof that they were really competent artists. Their reputations rest secure on the basis of the programs that they gave and the early discs they made, and also the reviews. Almost all of them made a few poor records in off moments, and somehow, mostly due to problems of recording in the old days, while these records were not suppressed as they would be today. And sometimes the singers also were careless about it. In the old days, a singer, particularly in the early days of recording, would maybe only make one cut of each of the sides and then receive a bag of coins and go out. That was the last they'd do anything about it. So then the rendition was released, and it might be very faulty. Since the time of World War I or so, why singers have usually made several, sometimes as many as a dozen records of the same number. Gallicurcia used to go flat and have problems, and she made lots of cuts. So anyway, the best take was then released. They listened to them carefully. Thus, on the basis of their recorded art in the old days, we can often judge the older singers better than some of the modern ones with all the tricks they have now with material. So without any intention of damaging reputations, here are some of the problems from the mostly singers of the old period, when we have more of these problems then. So for our first number today, just to get us off to a fine or rather bad start, but the right mood, as it were, we're going to hear a really poor recording of the Miserere from Verdi's Il Trovatore, sung by Ferruccio Giannini, a well-known operatic tenor in the old days, a famous pioneer recording artist who recorded for Berliner and also for Victor and Columbia and so on. Actually, in many ways, he's more important as the father of famous people, the father of the great soprano Dussolina Giannini. He also was a father of Vittorio Giannini, the composer, and third child, Euphemia, was a fine operatic singer and a famous teacher in Philadelphia. So he was not only a singer himself, but had a great family of singers. This record, then, that you're going to hear, and that's why I'm starting with it particularly, has the dubious distinction of having been voted by a group of England English record enthusiasts as the worst operatic record ever made. So I thought that was the proper place to start somehow. Signor Giannini doesn't really sing so poorly on this record, actually, although the voice is rather white and pinched, but the whole record is quite ludicrous. He's accompanied by a band instead of orchestra and chorus, and for his beloved Leonora, he has only the blatant bleat of the cornet. The band does the chorus, and then the cornet joins him in a kind of horrid conclusion at the end of the record. So we're going to get off to a good start on our bad records by hearing Ferruccio Giannini sing the Miserere from Verdi's Il Trovatore, accompanied by cornet and band.
Let's see if our machine works now.
Well, the main problem with that one is that it goes on too long, actually. But I could have played other ones. He recorded the Miserere for 7-inch Berliner, for Victor 10-inch, for Victor 12-inch, that was the 12-inch, and for Columbia 10-inch, and maybe others that I don't know about. Anyway, why he recorded that all over the place. It's interesting to note that this same Ferruccio Giannini made the first operatic disc, as far as we know. This was in 1896.
Fred Gaisberg, the pioneer recorder for Berliner, describes the event and the music goes round. And I want to quote because it's kind of interesting. On a visit to Atlantic City one day, I discovered the handsome tenor Ferruccio Giannini in a provincial Italian opera company. Next day, he came to my studio and made records of La Donna Immobile and Questo Quello. These were the most successful and were the first operatic excerpts we ever brought out. They filled us with pride and for many months represented our only concessions to highbrow taste. Incidentally, the Miserere Berliner is in the Kansas City archive. So you can see that one over there if you go over and have a look at that wonderful archive today or tomorrow, whatever. Well, considering what a famous pioneer Signor Giannini was, so let's forget this mistake and we'll go on to Madame Emma Calvé, the most famous of Carmens. She was over 40 when she made her first recordings. Among her earliest, from Carmen, the 1902 recording, the Seguidilla. This is a very famous record, a valuable one among collectors, and it's up on the table there, along with many of these other records that I'm using today. So I brought them over to show you what the originals looked like. As the story goes, anyway, the famous Calvé was prevailed upon to visit the London loft where the early crude horn recording was done. She was the most famous Carmen in the world at that time. When she got there in 1902, she became apprehensive, claiming that it looked more like a rat's home than a place where she was to be immortalized on wax. Her fear of the horn caused her to sing a painfully constricted and off-pitch B natural at the end. Realizing her poor tone, Calvé immediately said, "Mon Dieu." And she swore right on the record. And not realizing that this would record as well as her song. The record's very rare, and it wasn't in the catalog very long. She made another one, and it's amazing that it was released at all. She couldn't have listened to it, I think, because she probably just got her gold and rushed off. Anyway, by Emma Calvé now, the most famous of Carmens, probably, of all time, sings the flawed 1902 recording of the Seguidilla from Bizet's Carmen. It's very well sung, as a matter of fact, right up to the end. She suddenly rushes. She had every right to say that too, once more after that. Landon Ronald, the famous composer and accompanist, was doing the accompaniment. So anyway, she sings it really quite beautifully. Much you can tell she's a great singer through it. But it's a fine example of a great singer who shouldn't have allowed that record to be released. Now, about 1900, Francesco Tamagna was the king of tenors, and Verdi chose him to create the role of Otello, of course. His recording of Otello's death scene probably never been surpassed by any other singer. Most of his records, made in 1903, are excellent, but his Di Quella Pira from Verdi's Il Trovatore is like Calvé's Seguidilla. It's well sung until the final tone, which is below the pitch, although not so painfully as Calvé's note, and Tamagno made no comments about it either. So notice the first high C, which is superbly taken and held as Tamagno now sings this flawed recording of Di Quella Pira, a record really marred only by the final tone, and that's the same record that is up on the table. Tamagno's recording is a very wonderful one in many ways, a very exciting and driving recording. You can tell a great artist there. The richness of Wagner's orchestra, I forgot to turn the thing on. The richness of Wagner's orchestra defeated many of the early singers for the phonograph. As fine as some of the old recordings by Nordica and Fremstad and Farrar were vocally in Wagner, the lack of adequate orchestral support left their Wagnerian recordings unsatisfactory. This is also true of several records by Joanna Gadsky, one of Metropolitan's most admired Wagnerian sopranos during the first two decades of the century. And Gadsky made several very beautiful recordings. Her recording of Euschlicht und die Meinklagen, for instance, from Lohengrin, is very beautiful, I think, and many others are too. 1907, she recorded Ich teure Heile, Elizabeth's greeting to the Hall of Song from Wagner's Tannhäuser. This recording shows the beauty of Gadsky's voice and her great poise, and parts of the recording are quite satisfactory. But the miserable orchestral accompaniment sounds foolish, and Gadsky's voice seems to lack spontaneity. Several of her tones, especially the last one, are very insecurely focused. Throughout the record, she has a tendency to sharp, and the result is unpleasant. And why in 1940, with all the excellent Gadsky discs to choose from, Victor repressed this one as an example of Gadsky's art, I really don't know. So Joanna Gadsky now, the famous Wagnerian soprano of the Met for many years, sings her somewhat unsatisfactory recording of Dies Tote Heile from Wagner's Tannhäuser.
Thank you.
you're just a little bit off most of the time, and she's just having a bad day, you can tell. Anyway, our next number is really not a very bad record, but I've always considered it one of the most disappointing items in my whole collection. Few singers have been so identified with any one role as the baritone Antonio Scotti was with Baron Scarpi in Tosca. He sang it when it was first presented at the Metropolitan in 1901. Every Scarpi since then has been compared to Scotti, and most of them to Scotti's advantage. Therefore, one would expect his recording of Scarpi's second act aria to be thrilling. But actually, it's very dull and lifeless, I think. Scotti never had a really great baritone voice, but he was a superb actor. All sources agree on this. But nothing exciting comes across in this record at all. In it, Scotti as Scarpia is saying all sorts of really nasty things to Tosca, which no gentleman should say to a lady at all. But it sounds as if he's asking her out to tea and croquet or something like that. Here, too, Puccini's lush orchestration, like Wagner's, escaped the old horn, and probably Scotti couldn't get very passionate in the cold studio and with this awful orchestra. The result is a very pallid recording of one of the most violently sensual passages in all of opera. Now, so, Scotti, the most famous of Scarpias, now sings Già mi dicon venal, yes, they call me venal, from Puccini's Tosca, Act Two. Voice is so constricted, it sounds like really having trouble getting it out somehow. It just doesn't convey what you think Scotti should. Anyway, if you want to really hear what he sounds like, get the Elisir d'Amore recording of Come Pari de Vezzoso. It's beautiful, and a lot of his other records are wonderful, but this one, and the duets, of course, with Cruz are fun. Anyway, now we come to a couple of really unpleasant items from Aida that you'll enjoy, I think. The first of these is the finale to the third act by Bernardo de Muro, tenor, Irma Vigano, soprano, and Aristide Baracchi, baritone. No one sings very well on this item, although they're all well-known singers, Italian singers, but De Muro's voice is almost unbelievably forced and pinched in the upper register in this 1923 recording. De Muro, of course, was a very fine tenor. He was leading tenor at Rome and La Scala, later a vocal coach at University of Michigan. He made many fine recordings, had a wonderful career, long career. His Dio mi potevi scagliar from Otello is superb. Several of his Andrea Chenier recordings are as good as any made, I think. But the day he made this in 1923, he couldn't have been feeling well. Something was wrong. As he starts the ascending phrase, Si fuggian da questa mura, his voice becomes dreadfully open and white, uncovered and forced, and this forcing of his voice continues throughout the disc. One feels he certainly loses his voice entirely before he completes the record. I treasure many of De Muro renditions, and I've given several programs about him from Lawrence, but here's another example of a bad record by an excellent singer. Bernardo De Muro, then, as the Radames, Vigano and Baracchi sing the finale to the third act of Aida. This one will really pain you, I'll tell you. Especially the start. Ooh.
Vieni, vieni, vieni. Rovina!
That's one of the most painful records I know of, I think, actually. But despite what you might think from that, why, De Mauro really made some marvelous records and was a wonderful singer, but that wasn't his day. Shouldn't have been released in 1923. It's even more amazing that our next Aida recording was ever offered to a long-suffering public. This is Celeste Aida, Radames Tenorei, for first act, sung by Gino Martinez Patti, another La Scala artist. Martinez Patti had a long career at La Scala, also was sang throughout Italy, was a favorite in Romania for many years, and he made some excellent gramophone typewriter and fonotopia recording. Then late in his career, about 1910, he made some Columbias, and this Celeste Aida is among them. How could anyone with an ear for music buy this record? That's what amazes me. This record has a flaw that I've never heard on any other disc, new or old. The tenor actually goes out of key in the middle of the record. As you can believe, this is just astonishing. He starts out about a half tone above the score key. Then, on the second time that he goes through Celeste Aida, he alters and goes back to score pitch, and then sings the rest of it in score. Now, was this a flaw of the singer and the orchestra working together to, so he didn't sing such high notes at the end? Was this a problem with the engineer changing the recording down because it sounded like it was going too fast? We don't know, but I wonder what you think. I'd be interested to hear what you think. It's one of the most curious records that I know actually of the old record. So listen for the change of key at Mistico Certo di Luce e Fior in the second verse of Celeste Aida. He never gets back to the original key, and is so flustered, I think, by the wandering that he almost literally bleats his way through the rest of the disc. So the last tone is not vicino al sol, but vicino al blah, kind of like that. A really kind of fearsome sound. So we're now going to hear Gino Martinez Patti's Celeste Aida. First part goes quite well again.
Oh.
That's a curious record, I'll tell you. I've never heard anything like that. So next, we're going to hear from a very famous record. One of the most brilliant coloratura sopranos who ever recorded was the Spanish Maria Galvani. She was a great favorite at La Scala and elsewhere on the continent. She recorded extensively with all the great singers of the era, Fernando de Lucia, Tito Ruffo, and so on. Her solos are amazing for a great range of voice, almost 3 octaves, and a rapid staccato. Far as I know, she could sing faster than any of soprano who ever recorded, but sometimes that got her into trouble. And nowhere is this more apparent than in her 1908 recording of the Queen of the Night's Vengeance aria from Mozart's Magic Flute. There's amazing vocalism on this little record, a favorite among collectors, but I think it's the most tasteless rendition of Mozart I've ever heard. The time values are all altered in order to show off Galvani's staccato. Ridiculous bravura cadenzas is added at the end, cadenza having nothing to do with Mozart and more to do with Florence Foster Jenkins, who doesn't appear on this program. The music is sung almost double speed, so that almost every intention of Mozart, I think, is violated. The errors on this record are mostly those of taste and interpretation and not of singing. So Maria Galvani sings in pitch, because I pitched it, and it's in score pitch, the famous De Heloracha in Italian from Mozart's Magic Flute. Can't you imagine poor old Mozart flopping around in his grave, wherever it was, after that happening? My goodness. Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, that could be put on the screen. You have a really nifty, cartoon version of that, I think. Well, now we come to one of my favorite French singers, the splendid Georges Thiel, probably the finest French tenor in the period between World War I and World War II. His manly voice, full top tones, and delicate shading, especially his wonderful French diction, are all famous, and he made outstanding complete recordings of a number of operas, Faust, Carmen, Louise, Werther. But even this fine artist could make an error now and then, and one of his flawed moments came in the complete recording of Werther. Why they didn't remake this 78 disc in the 1930s, I have no idea. The bad moment comes in the most famous aria of the score, Pourquoi me réveille? Why awaken me, the song of Ossian, as it's called, from Massenet's Werther. He does very well until the final high note, and then he almost loses it. You listen to this now. The voice begins to shred apart. Although he recovers it, the effect is not good, especially in this big aria, the climax of the score in many ways, and the disc certainly didn't help Thiel's reputation. So I think he should have made it before they allowed it to be put out, that they were doing that sort of thing regularly then. So now we hear Georges Thiel sing Pourquoi me réveille, mostly beautifully sung from the third act of Massenet's Werther. A wonderful voice. I really love his voice. He just that one tone, he begins to lose it somehow. Well, now we turn to one of the most famous Wagnerian tenors of the early part of this century, the period from 1901 to 1910 or so, if only to remind us that standards of Wagnerian tenor singing were rather low ebb at that time. There were no Alvares or Melchiors around. Most Wagnerian tenors of that period were described as barkers. At the Metropolitan, Karl Burian was the principal Wagnerian tenor in that period, between Jean Dorezky and Jacques Erlus. Some of Burian's recordings are quite well sung. Others are distinctly painful, again, because of, just as in the Demura record, the pinched strain quality of his high tones and very muscular production. So some of his records can have given little pleasure or added to his fame. An example of such is a recording by Karl Burian, that's very celebrated Wagnerian tenor of the test song, Fanget an, from Wagner's Die Meistersinger. Before he finishes, one wonders whether he's going to last out the aria, actually. So we'll hear Karl Burian.
Oh,
His voice tended to lose quality as he ascended the scale, and his recording that was released here from Die Götterdämmerung from Siegfried's narration is very similar to this, even worse, but it's longer, so I didn't play. So our next less than perfect disc is by one of the most renowned Italian tenors of the early days of the century, before Caruso. This was Francesco Marconi. He was very popular in Italy, especially in Rome, in the period from 1880 to 1910. He made two visits to the recording studios at Milan, the first in 1904, second in 1908. His recordings are quite rare and much sought after by collectors. In the 1908 session, he made an excellent recording of the Duke's short aria from the beginning of Rigoletto, Questa o Quella, in which the Duke says he loves all the girls and wives and doesn't care if husbands or lovers complain. In the earlier 1904 version, however, the famed Roman tenor, first Otello, for instance, ever heard in the United States, although a failure, does quite well with the first verse. He even interpolates a high note for some reason. Then somehow he misses his entry for the second verse. And so the piano goes on, da-dum, 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 but no Marconi. He's gone out for lunch or something, anyway. And finally, when he does come in, he seems flustered and tentative, and the voice becomes weak, and altogether it's not a recording that made Marconi famous, and it's a good idea that he re-recorded it later on. So we now hear Francesco Marconi sing the defective 1904 rendition of Questa o Quella from Act One of Verdi's Rigoletto. Thank you.
Well, despite his problems, you can tell he was a wonderful singer, and Marconi had really very beautiful voice. In 1907, Victor had the splendid idea of recording the final trio from Faust with Emma Ames, Paul Plançon, and Charles Dalmores. Emma Ames had studied Marguerite's role with Gounod in Paris and the part closely associated with her career at the Met. According to many critics, Plançon's Mephistopheles has never been surpassed, and the people who went to the Manhattan Opera House in those days considered Dalmores' Faust a more artistic portrayal even than Caruso's. So it should have been a really ideal combination, but the final result was dreadful. To begin with, it's very out of balance. Ames' voice is so forward that Dalmores and Plançon sound like they're down in a well somewhere, and perhaps she was placed too close to the horn, who knows. Moreover, Ames' voice is hard and forced, and her ending high B is very flat. In 1907, it was hard to record three powerful voices like this, all singing fortissimo. In order to avoid blasting, it was necessary to step back from the horn, or sometimes even to be pulled back from the horn, and momentarily when singing a loud tone so it wouldn't break the groove. And singers who forgot this, just as they were getting ready for a big note, suddenly they might be jerked backwards on a kind of trolley with, set up with roller skates on the bottom. And that would be quite an interesting sort of thing to happen to. Now, did this happen to Ames when she made this Faust trio? Well, we don't know. But in fairness, one has to remember that making records in the old days was often quite an ordeal. For our concluding a dreadful number today, we're going to hear the trio that should have been great. It was replaced a couple of years later by Caruso and Farrar and Journet's famous and wonderful record. But now, Ames, Plançon, and Dalmores sing the final trio from Gounod's Faust.
Thank you.
So that's some of, those are some of my favorite records from the Black Cabinet, as it were. So I hope you have enjoyed our program on some rather not so good records by famous singers.
Thanks, James, for that bad experience. Chuck, do you have something? Okay.